Warning, this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Glasses Manifesto.
How about the sex crime?
Yeah, that was in the Bronx. Two people were killed in that. That was my worst as far as the number of victims. I had killed two people at the time, a girl and a guy in a car. They were parked in his lover's lane and they were making out. I snuck up on him and shot them.
A Molasses Manifesto production brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. the Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog, carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
And now the need for a story, if not for anybody else, for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should spend my whole life here for what I've done.
Episode 15, To Whom It May Concern. Act 1, Valentina Suriani and Alexander Esau. At approximately 8:30 p.m. on the evening of April 16, 1977, David Berkowitz again grabbed the Charter Arms Bulldog 44 and left the apartment, driving south towards Queens. This time, not long after leaving, he was pulled over in a routine traffic stop by officers of the 45th Precinct. When asked for his credentials, Berkowitz could provide none, no registration, no proof of insurance. So Officer Jose Pinero issued a summons, and David Berkowitz was instructed to appear at traffic court on July 6th. Obviously having no intention of actually doing this, David Berkowitz readily agreed and drove off into the night. Once arriving at his destination, he drove up and down Queens Boulevard for several hours, looking for what he considered to be a suitable victim or victims. Finding none, he left the borough and drove back to the Bronx, where at approximately 3 a.m., he spotted a young man and woman in a maroon Mercury Montego. As he watched them, contemplating his attack, he quickly realized he was only about 6 blocks away from where he had murdered Donna Loria. Seeing some inherent significance in this, he made his decision, parked the car, and again, wearing a ski jacket, approached the two hapless lovers, raising the gun and firing 4 times. 10 minutes later, he stopped at a White Castle on Baychester Avenue, where he ordered a cheeseburger and a chocolate malt. Here's our series producer, Allison Baker.
In the spring of 1977, Valentina Suriani lived at home with her parents in a high-rise apartment building at 1950 Hutchinson River Parkway in the northeastern neighborhood of the Bronx called Baychester. She was 18 years old. Her father, Frank, worked at the post office and provided a modest but happy home for her and her mother, Marie. Valentina stood only 5'5", but was known for being a vivacious and confident young woman. She was an acting major at Lehman College and was pretty with wavy brown hair. She was an aspiring model and had plans to study at the Fashion Institute of Technology in Manhattan. Valentina's 20-year-old boyfriend, Alexander Esau, was the son of immigrant parents and a graduate of Brooklyn Technical High School. Tall and strong, he worked as an operator's helper for a tow truck company. On the night of April 16th, Alexander and Valentina left her parents' house at 9 p.m. to drive to Times Square and see a movie. They promised to be home by 3 a.m. Alexander had borrowed his brother's 1968 Mercury Montego for their date night, and Valentina, who had just recently received her driver's license, asked Alexander if she could drive them back home. When the movie was finished, he gave her the keys and she happily climbed into the back seat as they headed out of Manhattan towards the Cross Bronx Expressway. Exiting onto the Hutchinson River Parkway, Valentina got off on a service road and pulled the car over alongside a fence, just a block from her home. It was 3 a.m. when she turned off the engine, and the couple were alone on the quiet, poorly lit service road. With the windows rolled up and no one in sight, they leaned in close to one another. In an intimate moment focused on each other, they didn't notice the man lurking in the darkness. Suddenly, in an explosion of glass, four shots, one after the other, shattered the passenger side window. The first two shots ripped into Valentina's head. The last two struck Alexander in the top of his skull. The violent crack of the fourth shot rippled in the night, replaced by the sound of the unseen gunman's footsteps dashing over the gravel and into the dark. When the police arrived, Valentina was already dead. Her lifeless body was taken to the city morgue in Manhattan to be identified. Alexander, barely clinging to life, was rushed to Jacoby Hospital, where he died 2 hours later.
Jack asked David about this, his sixth attack with the 44.
How about the six?
That was in the Bronx. Two people were killed in that. That was my worst as far as the number of victims. I had killed two people at the time, a girl and a guy in a car. They were parked in the lover's lane and they were making out. I snuck up on them and shot them.
Quote, the sixth incident was in the Bronx, a double murder of a young couple on a service road of the Hutchinson River Parkway. It was my best job because it resulted in two deaths. Plus, I left my first carefully concocted note on the scene. My shooting pattern improved greatly due to my fearlessness, which slowly developed, and my two-handed shooting method. Four shots were fired. Three hit the victims out of four fired. The man was hit twice in the head, the girl once in the face. Now I was making the papers nearly every day. The chase was on and the public was looking out for me. This time I had been cruising for hours. I was headed up towards Yonkers along the Hutchinson River Parkway service road when I saw two heads over the seat of the car as I approached them from behind. I then drove my car around the corner and parked. I walked towards the car, dropped the note at the scene, and then opened fire. Valentina Suriani and Alexander Esau died. End quote.
No, it was over in a few seconds. So nasty way to put it, there's no other way. I just had to do it, you know. The act was more important than anybody suffering. In fact, I had gone out of my way to ensure that there would be, you know, this is a system. Unless it's written right, it would sound really, you know, crazy, but it wasn't. I tried to, convincing myself that I had to do this, I try to make it as easy as possible for the whoever might be the unfortunate victim.
Did you shoot right through like the last?
Yeah, it went right through. Well, this one here was in April of 77. I didn't give you the date on it. It was in April of 77. Most of the time the windows were closed. But the bullets had, that didn't stop them. It was a pretty powerful gun. And even a .22 can probably go right through a window and still retain a lot of velocity unless it was lead or lead bullet or something. Most are copper jacket, you know. So the windows were no obstacle. What can you do? You know?
Were they sitting up? Were they lying down?
Sitting up.
And did they see you at all?
No, it was maybe a few seconds, but it was too late. You know, you gotta understand the neighborhood, it was absolutely quiet and peaceful, you know. There's no noise or anything, no traffic. It was on a little lover's, like a so-called lover's lane, you know. And the suddenness of everything would just leave anybody stunned. A loud blast, you know, I was only 3-4 feet from them, you know, would I guess, leave somebody stunned so that they couldn't react in any extent, to any extent.
From a distance of only 3 feet away, David Berkowitz had fired at a young man and woman while they embraced, killing them instantly. His target, though, was, of course, the woman. He basically shot through the man to get to the woman.
It was clear from the beginning right through that his primary target was not the male, was, you know, a young woman. Men were the incidental, they were the collateral damage of his going after his intended female targets. He was clearly trying to pick out the woman, even in darkness and through car windows, and aim for the female target in every shooting. The men happened to get in the way, and they were more likely to be killed the closer they were, if they were embracing, whether it was romantic or not. He looked for women to kill, and several men got in the way.
It is interesting to point out that since David Berkowitz's primary target was women, the men who got hurt the most were the ones who found themselves in the closest physical proximity to the women they were with. The physically closer they were to the women, the more danger they were in. This, of course, was especially true if the pair were engaged in an act of lovemaking. Berkowitz had his own take on this, of course. Quote, "I'm trying to remember if Esau and Suriani were having sex. I know they were embracing, but I can't remember if they had their clothes off or not. If they did have their clothing off and were engaged in sex, then I would be somewhat justified in killing them. Sex outside of marriage is a heinous sin," end quote.
Right after the shooting, did you look inside to see what had happened?
No.
You just rammed the gun through the window?
Yeah, I didn't even look, you know. I just fired the gun, you know, in his direction, and sometimes I wasn't even sure if I'd hit anything, you know. I don't know. Can't figure that out. It seems to me like the killing itself wasn't even that necessary all the time, you know. Just doing it, you know, as if I'm saying, well, you know, I could have gotten you, you see, something, or I'm angry, but you're lucky you. I don't know. Can't explain it.
Disappointed if he misses, he's also disappointed if he doesn't, or at least claims to be, depending on how he's feeling from moment to moment. Jack asked David what he did immediately following the attack.
After your crimes, did you hang around? Did you view the aftermath? Or?
No, I just drove away. I read about it in the papers. It got to a point where, see, I didn't have to go back there, because after about three or four shootings, they already started the pattern, right? And when another crime with a similar MO would happen, all the press and all the media people from New York City went there. And then all I had to do was sit back in my own home, and they gave us close-ups of the car, with everything, you know. It was really sick when you look at it, you know, the way they flocked to the scene, you know, but you can see the news story building. I didn't even have to go there, again, because you saw everything right from the TV set. The cameras were right there, you know.
I don't think he ever returned intentionally to any of the crime scenes, but he did get satisfaction out of watching reporters crawl over and with cameras these later crime scenes where the world was becoming riveted and everyone at that point desperate to try to figure out why and maybe see a pattern, a threat or something that the police were missing. He just took it for granted at that point that he was going to be the lead story every night on the evening news.
David Berkowitz was being hand-delivered every gruesome angle and every horrendous detail of his own crimes right to the comfort of his living room in glorious color and high-fidelity sound. He was a star, and as a star, had finally permeated that ever-elusive membrane of TV glass that lay between the mediocrity of regular life and the exclusive world of fame and privilege that lay within. And so, being a monumental loser of epic proportions, I can only imagine he was completely elated by this. What a world, what a world. But at this juncture, it wasn't just his quote-unquote work that he was about to see presented back to him. He was also about to hear his own words as well. As David Berkowitz had begun with the Suriani and Esau murders to write quote-unquote what he called carefully concocted letters directly to those in charge of the investigation. And he left the first of those letters at the crime scene.
What did you need to know about it? What did you order?
Right alongside the car. You know, I just dropped it. It was in a sealed envelope, and I just dropped it by the car.
Did it have his name on it?
No, it had the guy who was running the investigation. He had his name on it. A Lieutenant Borelli.
You know what Borelli's first name is?
Joseph. Joseph Borelli. Borelli, I think.
Act 2. I Am the Son of Sam. Approximately 15 minutes before David Berkowitz shot Valentina Suriani and Alexander Esau, three detectives had been sitting in an unmarked car parked directly across the street from the precise location where the shootings would occur, at 1873 Hutchinson River Parkway, just a few minutes after they left. When their shift ended at 2 a.m., the three detectives decided to put in an extra 45 minutes, stretching their shift to 2:45 a.m. The murders, unfortunately, occurred at 3. They were stationed there because Sergeant Fred DeLuca had guessed correctly, as it turned out, that this particular spot was a likely spot for an attack to occur due to its close proximity to the highway, saying later, quote, "We figured areas near highways would be prime targets," end quote. Of course, this particular stakeout was not an isolated event. During that time period, police would perform more than 200 stakeouts throughout the city. Despite this, the murders continued, seemingly unabated. An hour after the shooting, at 4 a.m., April 17, 1977, Joe Coffey got a call from a Queens homicide detective. Quote, "We've got a homicide in the Bronx. It's similar to the other ones we're working on. I'm on the phone to the guys there, and the more I hear, it's got to be him," end quote. When Detective Coffey arrived at the city morgue at 520 First Avenue at 30th Street, he said, quote, "In a way, the girl was gorgeous, young, a classic. She was one of the prettiest girls I'd ever seen. But she was covered from head to toe with caked, dried blood. It was her own blood, and later we'd find it was the blood of her boyfriend, too," end quote. Back at the crime scene, 46-year-old police captain and second-in-command of the Omega Task Force, Joseph Borelli, had found Berkowitz's letter. The letter, addressed to him specifically, was written on cheap stationery, most likely purchased from a corner drugstore. In it, Berkowitz referenced something he had heard Borelli say on national TV a few days before. Quote, "The killer must have something against women," end quote. It was also the first time Berkowitz referred to himself as the Son of Sam. The date was April 17th, 1977. It reads as follows. "I am deeply hurt by your calling me a women hater. I am not, but I am a monster. I am the Son of Sam. I am a little brat. When Father Sam gets drunk, he gets mean. He beats his family. Sometimes he ties me up in the back of the house. Other times he locks me in the garage. Sam loves to drink blood. Go out and kill," commands Sam. "Behind our house some rest, mostly young, raped and slaughtered. Their blood drained, just bones now. Papa Sam keeps me locked in the attic too. I can't get out, but I look out the attic window and watch the world go by. I feel like an outsider. I am on a different wavelength than everybody else, programmed to kill. However, to stop me, you must kill me. Attention, all police, shoot me first, shoot to kill, or else keep out of my way or you will die. Papa Sam is old now. He needs some blood to preserve his youth. He has had too many heart attacks. Me hoot, it hurts, sonny boy. I miss my pretty princess most of all. She's resting in Our Lady's house, but I'll see her soon. I am Monster Beelzebub, the chubby behemoth. I love to hunt, prowling the streets, looking for fair game. Tasty meat, the women of Queens are prettiest of all. I must be the water they drink. I live for the hunt, my life, blood for Papa. Mr. Borelli, sir, I don't want to kill any more. No, sir, no more. But I must honor thy father. I want to make love to the world. I love people. I don't belong on earth. Return me to Yahoos, to the people of Queens. I love you, and I want to wish all of you a happy Easter. May God bless you in this life and in the next, and for now I say goodbye and good night. Police, let me haunt you with these words. I'll be back, to be interpreted as bang, 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 bang. Ugh. Yours in murder, Mr. Monster.
This was where he began in earnest playing the cat and mouse game with the police, who were falling all over each other, literally trying to find him. And he began to feel like, I am so much better than these guys. And it was a catch me if you can.
And apparently it was can't, because the letter was so thoroughly passed around before being preserved that it collected approximately 8 sets of individual detective fingerprints before being submitted for fingerprinting, rendering it completely useless as a method of identification. Also, it was leaked to the press. After it was printed on Sunday, June 5th, there was no longer any talk of the .44 caliber killer. After that, there was only, and for all time, the Son of Sam. Monday, June 6th, Mayor Beam directed Police Commissioner Codd to throw everything he had at the search for the killer. Quote, I knew the press was going to have a field day. Son of Sam, I even liked the name. And that in itself was terrifying. I knew that it would stick, would become his trademark. There had been attacks all laid at the feet of a single individual, and you could see it all building. The fears of people, including my own, and the headlong rush of the press to create a personality, someone they could build a story around. The killings were a horror. The police were under terrible strain. Everyone was beginning to question their inability to capture the gunman. The letter fused everything together. It was a man against an entire city, end quote. The strain was getting to everyone, and it seemed as though it was getting to David Berkowitz as well.
He realized that sooner or later something had to happen, and probably there was a part of him intellectually that at that point wanted to get credit for what he had done, not just as the anonymous Son of Sam, but as little David Berkowitz. He also wanted to make the police look as inept as he possibly could. He was excited by the game at that point, and that's because he was bored with the actual killings. He had mastered holding the gun and putting the bullet, for the most part, where he wanted them to go. So he had to do something to spice up the game, and that was to try to reveal more of himself.
Bored with murder and dead set on squeezing every last drop of publicity he possibly could from his crimes, David Berkowitz had begun a sort of ad hoc writing career. Of course, he was certainly not the first serial killer to do this. To this end, Jack asked Berkowitz where he got the idea, suggesting that maybe he got it from the notorious serial killer known as Jack the Ripper.
Did you get the idea for this kind of writing?
From Jack the Ripper book.
From Jack the Ripper book.
Jack the Ripper book. It said in the book, and I even had this underlined in my copy that was in my apartment, a small paperback book. It said that there's, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it's about these so-called psychopaths that always continue to write the police or the news media. It mentioned the Ripper and Rumblow, or whatever his name was, said that there was a great many of these so-called killers that have a need to flaunt their crimes and write the news media or the police and things, and I got it right after that, because I had that book even before the shooting started.
David had been studying Jack the Ripper, along with several other serial killers, long before the killings had ever begun. So it's anybody's guess how long he'd been planning not only the murders, but also the letters.
At that point, he was clearly out of control and doing everything he could to up the game and make it more of a literary event, a media event, raise the level of excitement. He would have been unable to stop or control it at that point. He talked about vacillating between his anger, which drove him to murder, and the guilt, which in some ways worked on him to try to control what he was doing, although he never tried very hard. And the letters to the police were an effort to expunge his conscience somehow, to impute it to evil forces and supernatural events. It's stop me before I kill again sort of thing, when he didn't want to be stopped until he had to be stopped.
Which proved convenient for Berkowitz, since there wasn't any sign that he was ever going to be stopped. Detective Marlon Hopkins, who worked in the task force at the time, had this to say, quote, "At this point, I was getting all psyched up. I found myself talking about it to my family, friends, everybody. Maybe I spoke about it to get it out of my system. I don't know. There was so much notoriety about this guy. It became a citywide thing. Lots of people became involved. Hundreds of phone calls flooded in. Letters came in. People suspected their neighbors. Someone passed someone on the street who didn't look just right, and that was called in. They were turning in members of their own family, policemen, firemen, city officials, policemen, or people from every walk of life. But we found that the great majority of the phone calls and letters that did come in were about people who actually did have psychological problems. Each one of the people who were reported had an investigation done on them." End quote. Borelli said of this time, quote, "Everyone had their suspect, and they were certain their man was the Son of Sam." End quote. With no solid central narrative to follow, the investigation fanned out wildly in every conceivable direction, the practical, the farcical, and even the academic, as detectives on the task force brought the case to a team of 45 psychologists in order to help them develop a profile on the killer. The meeting lasted 3 hours. It was reported that during the meeting, a German psychologist blurted out the following in a heavy German accent. "Gentlemen, every time he shoots his gun, he is ejaculating," end quote. Borelli said, quote, "All 45 psychologists laugh, along with the handful of cops who were there. We all needed a laugh. And in a way, maybe this guy was right. But in the end, we had to get back to the basic investigation. We were evaluating each of the calls and letters as they came in. We gave some top priority and some least priority. We acted on those that sounded best to the investigator who took it first. I'll say some of the suspects looked pretty good. Some looked so good that we followed them. We stayed with them from when they went to work in the morning until they went to bed at night. We virtually tucked some of them in at night," end quote. Sadly, none of them were David Berkowitz. Act 3, A Letter to Breslin. Hello from the gutters of NYC, which are filled with dog manure, vomit, stale wine, urine, and blood. Hello from the sewers of NYC, which swallow up these delicacies when they are washed away by the sweeper trucks. Hello from the cracks in the sidewalks of NYC, and from the ants that dwell in these cracks and feed in the dried blood of the dead that have settled into the cracks. JB, I'm just dropping you a line to let you know that I appreciate your interest in those recent and horrendous 44 killings. I also want to tell you that I read your column daily and find it quite informative. Tell me, Jim, what will you have for July 29th? You can forget about me if you like, because I don't care for publicity. However, you must not forget Donna Loria, and you cannot let the people forget her either. She was a very, very sweet girl. But Sam's a thirsty lad, and he won't let me stop killing until he gets his fill of blood. Mr. Breslin, sir, Don't think that because you haven't heard from me for a while that I went to sleep. No, rather, I am still here, like a spirit roaming the night, thirsty, hungry, seldom stopping to rest, anxious to please Sam. I love my work. Now the void has been filled. Perhaps we shall meet face to face someday, or perhaps I will be blown away by the cops with smoking 38s. Whatever, if I shall be fortunate enough to meet you, I will tell you all about Sam if you like, and I will introduce you to him. His name is Sam the Terrible. Not knowing what the future holds, I shall say farewell, and I will see you at the next job. Or should I say, you will see my handiwork at the next job. Remember Miss Loria, thank you, in their blood and from the gutter, Sam's creation, 44. Here are some names to help you along. Forward them to the inspector for use by NCIC. Quote, the Duke of Death, the Wicked King Wicker, the 22 Disciples of Hell, John Wheaties, rapist and suffocator of young girls. P.S. Please inform all the detectives working the slaying to remain. P.S. J.B., please inform all the detectives working on the case that I wish them the best of luck. Keep them digging. Drive on. Think positive. Get off your butts. Knock on coffins, etc. Upon my capture, I promise to buy all the guys working on the case a new pair of shoes if I can get up the money. Son of Sam, May 30th, 1977. The letter Berkowitz wrote to Jimmy Breslin was received on the afternoon of June 1st, 1977. And was printed in the Sunday, June 5th edition of Breslin's paper. By midnight Saturday night, thousands of New Yorkers were lined up to get a copy. First run sold out in about an hour. By the end of the day, the paper had sold more copies than they ever had in their entire history, a total of 1,116,000. Jimmy Breslin, being a guy with a keen sense of how to play on the public for dramatic effect, included a private message from him back to the killer. Breslin to 44 Killer. Give up. It's the only way out. He went further to say, quote, if he wants any further contact, all he has to do is call or write me at the Daily News. It's simple to get me. The only people I don't answer are bill collectors, end quote. At police urging, one page of the Breslin letter, though, was left out, as it contained content claiming knowledge of police procedure, causing David to say later that he was, quote-unquote, disappointed when he bought the paper that the article had only been partially reproduced. Disappointed or not, after the Breslin letter was printed, calls received by the Omega Task Force 844-0999 hotline number increased exponentially. The Breslin letter served as a switch of heightened hysteria. The city went apeshit.
When I mailed the second letter to Jimmy Breslin, this is how he recognized it, because of the first letter. The first letter was never publicized, and no one ever saw the writing, but the police, of course, kept it. And when Jimmy Breslin got this strange letter out of the blue, you know, it was, he got the letter, I think, a few weeks after that shooting, you know, or a month after the shooting, you see. When he took the letter over to the police, the heads of the investigation, he says, well, what do you think of this letter? And they read it immediately, the handwriting, you know, the way it was, remember, if you recall, set it apart, and they knew that was the second letter. Those were the two letters.
Why didn't you choose Roosevelt to send this stuff to?
I needed somebody. There was no real particular reason. Not that he was any good at anything, you know. He ran a few columns about the earlier crimes. You know, he expressed more interest than any one reporter from the other papers, you know. And so he ran the columns, and I had read a couple of his books that he'd written in the past about organized crime. So I wrote to him. There's no real reason.
Quote, I wrote Mr. Breslin because he was obsessed with the shootings. That was evidenced in his columns and how he wrote about them. I also wanted him to write about Donna Loria because the newspapers did not cover her properly. They just had Donna down as a name. pattern of the shootings were not figured out until much later, that all the shootings were connected. And after that, when people got shot, they got all the publicity. Before they figured out the pattern, nobody wrote that much about the victims, and I didn't want Donna to be forgotten. I felt a mystical attachment to her that I can't explain. I didn't think Mr. Breslin would ever publicize what I wrote him, but I wanted him to remember Donna Loria. I wanted him to write about Donna. It wasn't because of any feeling of sorrow on my part. I simply don't know what sorrow is, end quote. James Jimmy Breslin, 47 at the time, was a street-smart, tough-guy journalist who had come up writing sports stories about angry jocks and corrupt sports figures in the 1950s. After sports, he had moved on to the politics and mob beat. It was there, amongst the crooks and the politicians, that Breslin found his initial success. By the time The Son of Sam came around, having had always gravitated towards outsider stories, Breslin was clearly drawn to the case. As he had covered psychopathic killers before, it seemed his whole career had been inching him closer and closer to them from day one. Also, he lived within a mile or two of the attacks in Forest Hill, Queens. So in some ways, he came by the story honestly, as it had literally struck close to home.
Breslin was one of the first prominent journalists in New York City at that time to key in on these murders as something a little out of the ordinary. These are not random acts. There's some kind of pattern here. So the fact that Breslin was a celebrity and widely read in New York City than probably any other news person at that time, I think he saw Breslin as maybe an intelligent sort of columnist detective. Breslin made his bones covering mafia stuff and grisly stuff. He thought maybe he could play the little cat and mouse game with Jimmy Breslin the way he was playing it with the cops.
Jack asked Berkowitz if the letter to Breslin was his way of trying to deal with what he was doing.
Were some of the letters and notes that you wrote to Breslin, were they attempts to maybe deal with what you were doing by putting it down on paper?
I guess so, although I wasn't really cognizant of it at the time, you know. I suppose they were.
To give some sort of literary meaning to it or something?
To try to get some meaning to it or to convince the public or something. It was also silly, you know. I can't really explain it.
Okay. You can say it was silly, but if I go back to the parents of those victims,
yeah,
that's not the word that they're going to use at all.
Well, no, I mean, what I did was... I don't mean funny, you know. You know what I mean? I can't explain it. When I say silly, I don't mean funny. I mean, it was just so senseless would be a better word. Okay?
Not silly and not fun, but certainly senseless.
I don't think he had ever studied poetry or literature in any meaningful degree, except maybe the crime and pornography and homicidal pathology textbook stuff. But yeah, that was remarkable. New York was a very dirty, crime-ridden place at that time in many, many parts. It was before they began a serious effort to clean up what was a rapidly declining big urban ghetto.
Regardless of whether the letters held any kind of literary merit, their depiction of New York City at the time did strike a chord with people. But the only thing that David really wants you to know about them is that they weren't crazy. They were written, according to him, in order to encourage the police to catch him. Encouragement he felt they needed in order to get the job done.
Well, they weren't crazy letters, by the way. See, people look at them and say the man's deranged madman, but you see, they missed the whole point on the letters. The letters were actually to spur the police on, right? You see, to drive them harder because they see that this is like more serious than it is, you know. It's like to push the police into doing more to catch me. And people miss this. They just see the letters as a guy terrorizing. Yeah, well, I suppose I wanted to call attention to myself, you see, as a criminal, even though nobody knew it was me. But there was so much more that these people, the average person, doesn't ever see.
Despite any deeper meaning people may or may not have missed from the letter, police did manage to lift two partial prints that seemed to belong to the killer, although it took them 6 weeks. Later, prints from the letter would match prints taken from David the night he was arrested, as well as from the New York Firearms Control Board print that had been a part of the application for his rifle permit he sent in December of 1975, the same month he attacked 15-year-old Michelle Foreman with a hunting knife. When he was later asked why he wrote both the letter to Borelli and the letter to Breslin in block letters, Berkowitz said, quote, "The reason I printed the letters to Captain Borelli and Breslin was for effect. I wrote those two out first in longhand. Then I wrote them again in print without any changes. I thought the printing was more ghoulish looking," end quote. Act 3. Tensions are building. After the Breslin letter went public, the Omega Task Force was expanded to nearly 200 total personnel, making it the single largest operation in the history of the New York City Police Department. The type of detectives drawn to the task force were wild and varied. The hunt for the Son of Sam meant big wins and big losses, all of which would be taking place directly under the scrutiny of the public eye. Due to that, the operation drew extremists of every stripe. Some sought fame, some sought fortune, some advancements in their career, and of course, some sought justice. But all sought something, and they sought it feverishly. They worked around the clock, sometimes sleeping on cots in the back of the precinct, so they didn't have to go home between shifts. Sergeant Joe Coffey had this to say, quote, "There were days on end that I just never went home. Something was always breaking. Some new angle or suspect. The drive back to Levittown became a luxury I just couldn't afford. I began putting in 20-hour days. We all did. Finding him became the most important thing in our lives. Our families just had to understand," end quote. Another detective on the force said, quote, "As a father, you came to look on each killing as an act against your own kids," end quote. Due to this, emotions ran high, as everyone grew more and more on edge, sleep-deprived, and generally beaten down by the case. In their hunt to apprehend the killer known as the Son of Sam, detectives endured stresses of every kind. Marriages suffered. Families suffered. Lives were destroyed. For all, it was personal, but for none, it was perhaps as personal as it was for 51-year-old Detective Keenan, father of Rosemary Keenan, who was attacked by Berkowitz on October 23, 1976, and who, luckily, had survived. Detective Keenan had this to say, quote, "It might have easily been my kid. I know he was aiming for her. So let's just say I put a little more than I had to into this case," end quote. As the investigation ground on, the task force, in their efforts, pursued everything from the mundane to the extreme. On the more extreme side of things, they attempted to hunt down all 56 Charter Arms Bulldog 44s that had been registered in New York City, with the idea of gathering a test firing from each. They also attempted to track down every single one of the 28,000 44 Bulldogs ever manufactured full stop, an essentially impossible task, not just due to the overall number of the guns, as well as the geographic area they were spread across, but also due to the fact that guns can be legally traded and sold by private citizens, not to mention those guns that had been stolen or illegally traded, making them even more impossible to track. And, to make matters worse, all the while, public response was a pot boiling over. During the height of the Son of Sam attacks, the Omega Task Force switchboard received an average of 250 calls a day, and each call had to be answered, then put through a precise protocol. The officer receiving the call would make notes on a card, then they would place that card in one of three priority boxes on the sergeant's desk: high priority, middle priority, or low priority. all received some form of priority, which meant that all would have to be followed to their natural conclusion. Before it was all over, police claimed to have investigated a total of 3,167 suspects. Adding to the tension was, of course, the fact that some of the suspects were cops, but that's something we'll get into more in a later episode. For now, let's just say that the effect on the city was palpable. People quit going to restaurants and discos, creating an unbelievable strain on the industry. Discos that usually drew over 1,000 patrons a night were now virtually empty. The wine gallery, where John Diehl and Christian Freund had been before they were attacked, was so badly affected they almost closed down. Beauty parlors, on the other hand, had an uptick in business, as women mobbed the shops in order to get their hair cut short or dyed blonde. The city was on high alert while police struggled to find the killer. At this point, they were willing to try anything. On May 26th, just a few days before Jimmy received what would become known as the Breslin letter, police issued a profile generated by psychologists in an attempt to make the killer angry, so he would slip up and make a mistake. It read as follows, quote, "Neurotic, schizophrenic, and paranoid. He is probably shy and odd. A loner, inept in establishing personal relationships, especially with women," end quote. It is strange how in a situation like this, police needed the crimes to continue in order to catch the killer. If the shooting stopped, no new evidence would be collected, and the investigation would stall out. If the shootings continued, however, there was hope. It was a catch-22. On June 7th, 2 days after the Breslin letter was printed in the paper, David Berkowitz failed to appear for the traffic summons he had received, and as a result, his driver's license was suspended and notice of the suspension sent to the Department of Criminal Justice. David Berkowitz was now on the books for the first time in his life. Next time on Killer Tape, David continues to kill as the city, in an absolute state of crisis, starts to break down.
Bayside, Queens. A guy and a girl were wounded there. No one was killed. This is the sixth night you're on, right?
So.
No, something's wrong. This one.
I got sixth is in the Bronx, two people killed.
Yeah, that's right. I lost track myself.
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistance by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Wildenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Killer Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D., and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt, Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.